Welcome to the Hockey Strength Podcast, the official podcast of the world's best resource for hockey strength and conditioning information. HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 40 of the Hockey Strength Podcast, the official podcast of HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com, the world's greatest resource for training hockey players. Today, we're going to be talking to Bill Knowles. He's a reconditioning expert, and he's going to be talking to us about a little bit about his presentation for the SCAF meeting last weekend, and he's going to be talking a little bit about the difference between reconditioning and rehab, and how we can take a little bit more of a proactive approach to getting our athletes back in the game. So we're going to have this up on the site. The podcasts, of course, are free. If you are new to HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com, you can check it out for just a dollar for the first 7 days. After that trial week, you can stick with us for $14.95 a month, or you can invest for the year at just $149, and that gets you basically 2 months free. If you haven't checked in a while, check out the new articles. We're looking at a couple articles from Devin McConnell. We've got Hockey Performance and PRI. It's a big article. There's a lot there. Great information from Devin. Also from Devin, we got some videos about his anti-rotation progressions, so the stuff he's using there at UMass Lowell. Also, the last podcast, of course, is free. We've got Ben Velasquez talking about getting proactive with concussions, and our most recent program on the site is Daryl Nelson's Phase 1 strength training program for the U.S. national team, so that's always good to see from Daryl. Also, Mike Boyle's got a post up with us, other people's athletes, talking about how we can work with other people's athletes during the off season. And there's lots more. Check it out. The articles and the programs and the videos are all members only. So if you're new to us, join us for that buck and check everything out. We know you're going to love the content, and hopefully you stick with us for all the new content coming out. All right, so that's enough about the site. Let's go ahead and get started with our conversation with reconditioning expert Bill Knowles. All right. Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us for episode 40 of the Hockey Strength Podcast. Today, we're talking with SCAF presenter Bill Knowles. Bill is going to be presenting at the meetings this year. He's a world-renowned expert in reconditioning. He's worked with athletes and teams from across the globe. He's had Olympic athletes, world-class and professional athletes, and he's lectured internationally on his training methods of athletic development and injury prevention strategies. Bill, thanks so much for joining us before you head out to the meetings in Nashville.
Yeah, it's great. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. So, you know, you're presenting to a hockey crowd, and I guess before we get into the applications to hockey, I'd like to talk a little bit. How did you find yourself in this reconditioning role? What about, you know, there must have been something along the way where you thought, hey, something's not right here. So what brought you to this reconditioning role?
Yeah, it's interesting. I started in the role, you know, as an athletic trainer, and I am an athletic trainer by trade traditionally. And I went to a sports academy for alpine ski racing. And when I arrived at that school, they were only there for alpine ski racing. You know, you got about 80 to 100 athletes and so forth. But there were a lot of injuries, especially knee injuries. So through the process of having to bring these athletes back from their injuries, I was also responsible for that transition to get them ready to go back to just training for alpine ski racing, you know, getting ready to get them back on snow. And it was that transition zone, which I was saying, you know, it really is a form of just strength training. It's really not rehab anymore. And that kind of what dovetailed into this concept of reconditioning, which has been out there for many years. But it was a blend of basically taking it from the early stages post-injury to then what do they have to actually look like when they need to go back to team training, in this case, get back on snow or hockey to get back on ice. And it was looking at that much of the rehab protocols really weren't truly addressing the needs of what an athlete is required to have prior to get back to team training. It was underestimating the true demands. So that's how it all came in. It was based on a need, working with a lot of athletes who were injured, yet there was no one that was hand-holding the process all the way through. There was a gap between kind of late-stage rehab and then performance training. And that's when a lot of athletes are kind of lost, and no one's really picking up the pieces there.
Yeah, great. And I think, that taps into what we see a lot of now, and that is kind of that seamless transition and with sports performance staffs on teams now, it's no longer just see the athletic trainer until you're healed, and then see the strength coach to get you a little bit stronger. So it sounds like you're using that, kind of blending those two for the entire process.
Yeah, it's very true, and I consult with a lot of professional teams and organizations, around the world, and we go in. Everyone's dealing with a very similar problem. The transition of how you handle the athlete is not smooth, and it really isn't even a transition. It is the integration of all departments: the doctor, the athletic trainer, a therapist, a performance coach, a skating coach. And you name it, nutrition, sports psychology, they really are still siloed in their departments. And many professional organizations, some of the best teams in the world, still aren't integrated to the degree that would benefit the athlete the most. And that's a problem. And so they're not putting the athlete at the most important issue. They're putting their reputation or their area of expertise as the most important, when in fact it's not. It's a combined effort by everyone all the time.
So where do you start with that, Bill? I mean, obviously, an acute injury is something that has to be cared for immediately. And actually, in reading some of your stuff, it says you say reconditioning follows a functional path immediately post-injury. There's a lot of talk, and we know a lot about, well, we're knowing more about pain, and what pain can do to
Yes.
alter movement patterns and things like that. So how are you? It sounds like you're starting to work with athletes right after, immediately post-injury, to kind of recondition. How are you avoiding pain, or what do you find that pain and the actual injury itself, how do you work around that while training the whole body?
Well, it's a two-part question because it was like, how do you get the team to start recognizing that immediately after injury? And then also immediately after surgery, there's a system that has to be put into place to get athletes on their path to a return back to training, team training, practices, and then eventually to competitions. So ultimately, the leader oftentimes of that team can be the doctor. So you have to get your team doctor or the doctor in your community, whatever, you have to get them on board to say, we want to follow a very progressive functional path. To your second part of your question is to say, because if we can ultimately reduce this athlete's pain, we can then improve their function very, very quickly. And function doesn't mean he's back on ice or she's back on ice. It means is that you're just restoring normal movements. And initially normal is walking or moving your shoulder, whatever the injury is. And then it's squatting. It's not back squatting. It's just bending down in a chair and standing up and sitting down, but normal movement strategies. And in order to do that, we've got to have access to be able to coach the athlete and allow the athlete to do these things in multiple environments. So if it hurts to squat on land because of a back injury or knee injury or an ankle injury, I understand. We'll squat them in the water because you're offloaded significantly. But see, that's training the brain to good movement. And what I'm experiencing over the past number of years is the faster we can get an athlete moving normally, even if it's in water, even if it's offloaded, whatever it might be, the quicker their pain subsides. And we're able to get these athletes off drugs really fast. Painkillers, anti-inflammatories, anti-fibrotics, all of the things that are prescribed typically during a phase where you put an athlete, make them immobile, right? Rest them. Put braces on them. Don't let them move. And what I'm seeing is like that's a big source, that immobility and lack of movement, that's the source of the pain. And then we take drugs to deal with it rather than just get them functional.
Wow, I see. So it's almost, you take an athlete out of his element or her element, and you have them on the sidelines, and that's going to be probably the place where they're most uncomfortable. So you're saying that the movement itself actually brings them back closer to homeostasis, even though they're not performing at the high level, or even though they may still have that tissue injury, or the surgery is still healing.
Yeah. You know, when we talk about these all the time as being brain injuries, it was a long time ago that I started, you know, saying that, and I didn't understand it. I just knew that this insult on a knee injury or a hip injury, whatever, it's not about just that local, you know, area. You know, it's a neurophysiological injury. I didn't understand that many, many years ago. I just knew is that we've gone from an athlete who's, you know, quote unquote, moving well, moving normally, to then an athlete who's no longer moving normally because of injury, because of illness, whatever it might be. And that is a source of poor qualities, stiffness, poor timing. Well, over time, we know is like the brain for us as humans, it was for movement. It wasn't for cognitive. It wasn't for thought. It wasn't for intellect. It was for motion and movement and running and survival. And I think is we make the brain and the body kind of dumb in our protocols because the do no harm program is about shut them down, reduce movement because you want healing to take place in an area. But I'm more convinced is that this healing takes place better when the brain and body coordinatively feel that motion and movement is restored. And it has nothing to do with performance movement. It's just literally like activities of daily living, squatting, bending, that type of thing. So the quick one would be you can have hip surgery. And a lot of hockey players have hip surgeries. And you can lay on your back in a CPM machine, these continuous passive motion machines, right, that bends your hip up and down for you. Or the next protocol is they put you on bikes. And for a hockey player sitting on a bike, it really shortens the hip. It's not a great movement for hockey players. And those are the number ones. Or you can get them in water and do deep water running. You can get them up to their chest. All of a sudden, they're actually doing a running mechanic or a pushing mechanic. You have a choice. You can go with something that is really more natural in a functional movement strategy, or one that's not natural, thinking that it's going to help the area heal, but it's actually taking away from where the athlete ultimately needs to get to. So move it or lose it, basically, the old adage, right?
Yeah, and, you know, there is, too, I think we also know a lot about, you know, the mechanical forces on mental health and gene expression and all those kinds of things. Like, we're knowing more and more about that. So that's, you know, almost getting back to, like, the MoveNet philosophies and things like that, where you're meant to move in a certain way, and if you're not moving in those certain ways, then you're not in an ideal environment. So you're using that environment to bring them back. That's awesome.
Yeah, and what we're seeing is that routinely, because I dealt with hockey players, NHL guys, and first round draft guys, and things who have gone in and have those hip surgeries and things, back surgeries, and they're on meds, and the fastest thing we try to do is get them off medications because it's a false sense of homeostasis. It's a false sense. They're on drugs, so they feel good. And so we actually get the motion, get the movement. That starts to make them feel better. Get the muscles firing and use neuromuscular control as a brace, not a hip brace, not a shoulder brace, not a back brace or an ankle brace. Get neuromuscular function moving because that's the best brace on the market. If we use that, the athlete instills confidence, they decrease pain, they get off the medication, and we're on a path of homeostatic loading that's predictable now.
Yeah, I guess I'm still a little bit stuck, I guess, on my original question. I think, and I've seen it a lot, you know, we have therapists that work in our clinic or in our facility. I'm a little bit stuck on, I mean, I've seen pain change a motor pattern. Are these athletes that you're working with, are they working around something that could be painful for them? Do they come out the other side a little bit different, or are they working around it temporarily and then as pain subsides, they're going back? Because that pain can change motor patterns for good, I mean, permanently. Do you see that at all?
Yes.
They look different when they're back?
Yeah, and so I had a Swiss hockey player who had, you know, right groin pain, so they did an adductor release, kind of sports hernia type thing. Mm-hmm. And then on the comeback from that, his left hurt, so they did the surgery on that side.
Jeez.
And then when he came back from that, his now right hip started to hurt. But he'd never had any you know, and he, I'm sorry, that's not true. His groin, the other groin, continued to hurt. And they said the pain is coming from your right hip because you got a cam deformity in the hip, you know, and the pincer and all these things. So part of a bony morphology that took place, and they needed to change that and have surgery. But the athlete was saying, look, I don't have any pain in my right hip. You know, I have no pain. Doesn't matter, but that's the source of the problem. So he did surgery on the right hip this time.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so then he's out of hockey for a year because his right hip pain. You know, he never recovered from the right hip surgery. Well, his groin felt better because he wasn't skating, of course. But so he could no longer slot properly, like in a chair. You know what I mean? Just sit down on the bench. Just sit down in the chair and stand up. So he had pain. So he no longer remembered what a normal squat pattern looked like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, good ankle, knee, hip flexion. And for a hockey player, you lose that timing of ankle, knee, and hip bending simultaneously. Well, that's the source of the problem. Like hockey players who lose ankle mobility, they have a tendency to break over at their waist a little bit more. And then that alters their stride. Then they get tight in the groins. Then they have groin surgery, you know, or it leads that way. So this Swiss hockey player who forgot how to squat, it was, how do we teach this athlete proper squatting mechanics? Because everything always hurt. Well, one of the reason things was we put him in the water and just let him mimic patterns because now he's light. So he doesn't have pain because he doesn't have any gravity on him, okay, so to speak. And so, yeah, he just starts remapping. And then we put a lot of we do a lot of neuromuscular stimulation simultaneously with movements. So we'll be stimming their glutes, we'll be stimming their quadriceps or hamstrings while they're squatting. So we're driving this afferent to efferent response, giving them stability and trying to remap this. And I like what you said. Yeah, it can change it quickly, right? So the idea that practice makes perfect and perfect practice and things like that, basically, is if we're not practicing the normal movement really well, then it changes fast. That's why I think the involvement of getting athletes more normal in their movement patterns and being creative ways to do it, you have to do it immediately after injury and immediately after surgery because it's you're changing the mapping.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer is yes, we're trying to work around the injury. Don't let the knee injury or the hip injury control the destiny of restoration of normal. Be more creative. Figure out ways in which you can do it better. And many protocols are saying the athlete can't squat after a hip surgery. We don't want them doing any squatting. But that doesn't mean they're not saying we don't want them to bend down. You know, they're more saying don't load it in a squatting pattern. All right, so offload it, but train the squatting pattern. Protect the athlete through restoration of normal, because the long-term consequence of poor training in the beginning, it affects them at the back end of their reconditioning cycle and return to team training. There's a consequence on the backside, potentially.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a decrease in re-injury? You mentioned the player that, you know, had the bilateral hip surgeries and ended up with a total of three maybe. And do you see a decrease in injury on the other side? Things that, you know, historically are prone to re-injury. We know that the greatest predictor of future injury is past injury. Do you see a decrease in that? Do you have numbers or experience with that?
Well, it's hard to say, like, do you have numbers only because of, you know, one person, one practitioner is just not going to get enough, you know, end value to have it be really strong. So you go on anecdotal and just say, look, these are a lot of what I've been seeing, and these are a lot of the results. So you're absolutely right. You know, the biggest predictor of injury is the previous injury. I see that to say, to continue to drive this idea that these are neurophysiological responses. And there's more paper and there's more data to show that clearly there's a disruption at the central level, you know, up in the brain, that is far more powerful than just strength is concerned or bilateral strength. So this insult has long lasting effects and it can be a year and a half, and 2 years. So there was a study that's come out the past couple of years talking about ACL injuries, and it was mainly looking at soccer players and rugby players and stuff. But basically it said if you don't complete the rehab process, you're four times more likely to re-tear. Okay, but what the heck does complete mean? So it really means is that you've got to stay with the process of getting an athlete back strong, really improving rate of force development. But then it's what are you doing for the next 6 to 12 months after they get back? That's where we're reducing the either re-injury rate or the opposite side injury rate, because it's a bilateral consequence. The nervous system doesn't just say one side has got hurt. It's diminished neurologically. It's bilateral. And it's not only on knee or quad to the other knee or quad. It's the whole system. So an ankle injury for me on the left ankle, that's an increased risk of his left hip. That's an increased risk of his right hip, because many hockey players have hip pathologies, right? They have them, but they're stable.
Mm-hmm.
It takes an insult or an injury somewhere, and it can be concussion sometimes. I have a colleague, Canadian, Dr. Mark Lindsay, who's really studying this right now. He's doing a PhD. The insult and the consequence of a concussion can oftentimes just cause this little dimmer switch, you know, shutdown, where you just, there's a cessation of good neuromuscular control in the body, which can expose an area that is waiting to be injured, so to speak. It's waiting to be overloaded, and they get overloaded. So the problem you're describing, saying, yes, it's bilateral, if we do it really well, does it affect the opposite side? And the answer is yes, but it all comes down to just doing it really, really well, but tracking these athletes long-term.
Mm-hmm.
When they get back to team training or they get back to competition, that doesn't mean anything. It's about the ability to stay back. So we have to apply the principles we use to get them back for another full year, intensively for at least another full year.
So what does this look like? You're at HP Sports, which is outside Philadelphia. It's in Wayne,
mm-hmm.
Pennsylvania. You have a team there. What does this look like with your team? Let's say somebody comes in or contacts you with an injury. How does the process go at your facility?
So the HP Sports and how we implement that in is that an athlete from, say, Australia who's coming in, he's 4 months out of an ACL injury, knee injury. And he might come in for 2 weeks, he could come in for 3 weeks, and so forth. And what we're doing is we're putting into practice saying, all right, let's assess where we think this athlete is in this journey on his way back to team training, and get a good history on what he did postoperatively, get a good history on what he's been doing in rehab and reconditioning, so to speak, and then try to find what do I think are some of the things this athlete is still lacking. Oftentimes, they would say, We like a soccer player, a rugby player, an Australian rules football player. So we really like their strength. We've been back to running. We've been doing all these things. And I would often assess and be like, yeah, I don't agree that he's as strong as you're saying. I also feel that his movement patterns, his movement skills, the timing isn't that good because he's lacking a little bit of rate of force development, most likely, because that happens with these injuries. And then you might be emphasizing the wrong things. You're emphasizing like running, yet the athlete doesn't necessarily have the strength, the explosive strength, or the deceleration qualities in order to sustain running or change of direction in the coming months. So oftentimes teams put certain values on things like, yes, we got the athlete back running, which is like really popular in not only hockey, but in, you know, soccer. You come off an injury and they all just want to get back to running, when in fact, these injuries happen with deceleration and change direction oftentimes, knee injuries. Or hip injuries are happening oftentimes because of just pure lack of extension. So then they're lacking a lot of the things that that cause the injury. They're lacking the improvement, yet people are overlooking that. They're just trying to get him back saying, yeah, he's pretty functional. This athlete can get back skating. And I'm like, if we really look at it, though, they're still not at a place that they can sustain skating. So I would look at this when these athletes come back or come to me at HP Sports to prioritize the things that they need to work on in the coming, you know, 6 weeks or so. And then we have discussions with them to say, when the athlete gets back to team training, you know, on the pitch or on the ice, it's really about owning that ability to sustain training day in and day out before we rush them back to competition. So that's what it looks like. And we do some testing, but we do a lot of training. There's a lot of movements. We do a lot of gymnastics work. We teach them how to run. With a hockey player, we're looking at more lateral capacity, really good movement mechanics, things like that. But we train them. We're training them pretty hard.
Great. And I know in your consulting work, you're talking with teams and other sports performance teams. Are you getting a lot of buy-in? Are you having good compliance with the teams that you're consulting with? Are you able to help them integrate this process?
Yeah. I mean, fortunately, I've been doing it for a long time, and I've had some good results, and I've worked with a lot of good athletes and good teams. So there's a level of credibility mm-hmm. that gives me, you know, the flexibility to have the conversation, potentially a more progressive conversation than some teams are used to. But at least it gives me a chance to open the door and have that conversation. And then it oftentimes gives, you know, the full ability to then implement my strategies that I think are in the best interest of the athlete. We video, you know, we write reports, you know, we have Skype chats and conversations with the team. Many of these teams send one of their strength coaches or fitness coaches or physiotherapists. They'll send them along for a week, and then another one might come for another week. And they'll use that for a form of, you know, continuing education. But it really, for me, I encourage it because I want to have as seamless of a transition for the athlete so that they understand what the athlete was working on. But most importantly, that they understand my perspective on what I think is necessary to advance the athlete, but really then protect the athlete. Now, you can't avoid all injury and re-injury, that is, but we're doing pretty well. When these athletes are coming back, we're doing pretty well that they're staying healthy. But yes, have there been failures, meaning athlete returns and then tears their opposite knee? It happens. You know, we can't stop everything. But we're doing pretty well in that most guys are staying very healthy when they come back. It's working.
Yeah, awesome. And I think, you know, like you said, it's just a healthier place for any athlete to be. Nobody likes to be the guy on the training table. Nobody likes to be the guy, you know, away from the team. So when you take an athlete out of that element, it's a serious psychological effect as well.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Bill, thanks so much. I know if you guys aren't able to make it to Nashville for the SCAF meetings or by the time this comes out, we'll come out after the meeting. So if you didn't make it to Nashville for the SCAF meetings, you can catch Bill at the Perform Better Conference or the Perform Better 3-Day Summit in Providence on July 16th, presenting on this idea there. So thanks again. And that was really interesting stuff. And we appreciate you taking time.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right. That's going to wrap up episode 40 of the Hockey Strength Podcast. Thanks to Bill Knowles for joining us. I think he's definitely got a different way of looking at things and maybe something that's going to change the paradigm in terms of how we look at getting our athletes healthy and how we look at getting them back into the game. So definitely lots to learn there and definitely a lot more to look into. So thanks to Bill for joining us. If you have not already, check us out on social media. We're on Twitter at @joinus@HSC. We're also on Facebook. We share a lot of information, a lot of articles on our social media that does not make the site. So make sure you check it out. There's a lot of additional resources there. And of course, that one's free along with the podcast. So hopefully you're getting enough information and it spurs you to join the site and really dig into the information we have there. But again, thanks so much for joining us. And until next time, be sure to train smart and check out hockeystrengthandconditioning.com, the world's greatest resource for training hockey players. Take care, guys. We'll talk to you soon.